Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. You're on whatresistanceradio.com or altrighttv.com. Lots of more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, we had a great protest today in Kelowna, British Columbia. Kelowna is a city in the middle of the Okanagan Valley, which is in the middle of British Columbia. It's, I believe, British Columbia's third largest city. Anyway, at first it didn't look as though we would be favored by good weather. It was raining quite hard, but by the time we arrived in Kelowna, those of us who came from out of town, it was overcast, but pretty good. When we got people from all the way down around the American border at Soyuz, all the way up to Salmon Arm, which is up at near the head of the Okanagan Valley, and of course, lots of people from in between, from places like Vernon, and Penticton, and so on, and. The main thrust of the rally was to end the lockdown, and organizer Dave Lindsay said that he called the so-called epidemic a scamdemic. But while there is some truth to the fact coronavirus is a virus, and it is it can kill you. All right. But it will likely only kill you if you are old and already suffering from other medical and debilitating illnesses, or, in rarer cases, if you're young and suffering from debilitating cases. If you're massively overweight, have respiratory issues, and so on, and if you get it, just like if you get the common flu, and every year, thousands of people die from one or another of the strains of what's sometimes called the common flu. severely compromised bodies, especially respiratory systems, can give out under the pressure of flu, and that includes the coronavirus. A point we wanted to make was that we're sick and tired of having our liberties taken away. And a strong point here is that you quarantine sick people. You don't quarantine healthy people. But that's in part what the lockdown is. You're supposed to stay at home. In fact, now, of course, this is Canada, and we're talking about the situation here, but in England, the lockdown is so severe that you can be punished and fined. Apparently, they fined over 9,000 people if you are away from your residence except for a medical emergency, to buy food, I believe to walk your dog in the neighborhood, or to go to work. Otherwise, you can't go out. Now, it's not quite so bad here. But one of the things we wanted to point out is, hey, we are in favor of individual rights, not group rights. We're also in favor, or rather insist, on treating people as adults. Not as morons, not as idiots, but as adults. Think about it. If you are basically locked down in your own house, or worse still, tiny little apartment, it is assumed that you are sick. Totally erroneously, you are being treated as if you are sick. We don't have any problem with the notion that if somebody has coronavirus, they should be quarantined, and they think, you know, say for 14 days until they appear to be free of the illness. Just like if you have a regular flu, you should probably stay, especially if you've got a fever, you should stay home from work, you know, isolate yourself as much as you can from the other people you might be living with, wash your hands frequently, and all those good things. Yeah. But you should not be quarantined because you're healthy. And that's what the shutdown of this society is doing. Restaurants are closed, bars are closed, many shopping areas are closed, you know, clothing stores are closed, libraries are closed. I was going by a library this morning where I was going to pick up a person who was going to join us in the protest, and there's a sign on the library door, closed for the coronavirus. I thought, but there's no connection. If the rule is to stay 6 feet away from another person, all right. Does that mean people could not go to the library and maintain most of the time a social distance? You know, go in, read books if you wish, keep 6 feet away from other people, check a book out. And try to, you know, it's not that difficult to figure this out. I guess you put your library book and your card on the table. The girl swipes it and gives it back to you. Intelligent people can figure these things out. Why must we be treated as if we all have the plague? Well, the shutdown is irrational at best. Now, some people suspect a darker agenda. And I don't really want to debate that. I mean, I have some trouble understanding how shutting down our society and wrecking the economy, it will advance somebody's long-term goals. Maybe it does. I suspect a lot of this, though, is just panic. And, of course, control freakery. There are elements in our society that just love to boss other people around. And this gives them a great old opportunity to do that. So it was a big success in Kelowna, British Columbia today. There will be, we understand another group is putting on a rally this Saturday in Kelowna. We understand that there, and then the group that did it today will be holding another rally, not this Saturday, but next Saturday at 11 o'clock in Kelowna. Now, that's just one place. And now there's more talk of coordination, as there well should be. People should coordinate, people should work together. This is spreading, I'm extremely excited and positive about this. This is definitely the right way thing to do and the right way to go. And I strongly urge people, if you are being told to do something and you don't understand why, ask. Don't just accept it. Like, if the rule doesn't make any sense to you, ask. Why am I being asked to do this? Rather than just blindly accepting, they must know what they're doing. No, but the dangerous thing is they probably don't know what they're doing. But they want to shove you around. And that's how this thing is going more and more. It's a power grab. It's urgent that people resist and demand to know why. Why? You lay a rule on me. If it doesn't make any sense to you, why? Demand to know why. For instance. You will be told that in some places that you have to line up outside the store, they'll only allow a couple of people in at a time. Well, unless it's a very, very tiny store, ask why. Why is it only two people being allowed in a big auditorium sort of place, or only five or six? Well, why? I mean, the rule is you stay 6 feet apart. Fine. We're adults. We can do that. Why only allow a minuscule number of people in, which makes people stand outside, and if the weather's not very good, with some danger of perhaps catching a cold. Never mind the coronavirus. An inconvenience. Why must I be treated like a sheep, and a stupid sheep? Push back, and don't put up with it. Well, the price of dissent in Canada is loss of your job. Now, here's the story of a fellow. He's a Hindu. His name is Ravi Huda. He's the latest victim of cultural Marxism in Canada. He's a REMAX agent, a real estate agent. He's also an immigration consultant, and he has some volunteer role with the Peel Board of Education. Well, he doesn't have that any longer. They got rid of him right fast, and REMAX has fired him. And Ravi Huda posted objections to Mississauga allowing Muslim caterwauling to call the faithful to prayer during Ramadan, even though they're not supposed to gather. This is the nutty thing about it. The city of Brampton, city of Mississauga, also the city of Ottawa, allow the local mosques to have the hooting and hollering, I think, 5 minutes a day, that loud speaker, which otherwise would violate local noise ordinances. Let's be quite clear. That was the technology of a different era. Before there were telephones, before there were emails and text messages and things like that, perhaps the muezzin, that's the caller, would five times a day get up to the top of the mosque tower and holler out as loud as he could to draw the faithful to prayer. Well, that's a different place, a different time. Pretty much the same as the old town crier. The town crier would run around a village and go to the public square or other places where people would buy, gather, and he would holler out the important messages or the news of the day, or as the case might be. That's a different place, a different time. It's utterly unnecessary today to have this muezzin, now of course using a loudspeaker, hollering out in a foreign language the call to prayer. Assuming the faithful are so stupid that they need to be reminded. There's Twitter, there's text messages, there's phone calls, there's email, there's all sorts of modern methods that are non-intrusive. But here's the other thing. The call to prayer is empty, because they can't get together to pray. At least not in the mosque. In fact, outside perhaps their own homes, they're not supposed to gather in larger numbers than five in the province of Ontario. That's actually a call for them to break the law. So it's unnecessary. Anyway, this fellow by the name of Ravi Huda, he objected to that. He put some stuff up on his Facebook. And it wasn't long before those who hate, absolutely hate, freedom of speech. And they call themselves the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, and the three, the three stooges, or the stooges were comical. These people are not comical. They are hard-bitten totalitarians. Richard Warman, longtime battler of free speech, goes back 20 years. Even Evan Balgord. And Bernie Farber. Bernie Farber used to be the chief executive officer of the old Canadian Jewish Congress. That went out of existence. He assumed several other roles along the way. And he's now the chair. Hey, I don't know if he's a chair, has he? I thought he was a Jew, but he's a chair. I guess they mean chairman or the head honcho of this Canadian Anti-Hate Network. So what do? They got on I'll tell you, this is what they say. This is them gloating what they did. REMAX agent and registered certified immigration consultant Ravi Huda is upset that Brampton is giving mosques the same noise bylaw exemptions as churches. In Mississauga, a nightly call to prayer during Ramadan has become a focal point of anti-Muslim hatred. No, I'm not hating anybody. It's a matter of why are we giving minorities special rights, special privileges to make a nuisance of themselves? It's not necessary. Even if you want to grant they want to call the faithful to prayer, fine, but they don't have to do it. So Ravi Huda objected to that. Huda doubled down when challenged, citing freedom of expression and saying his opinions are not some imaginary phobic. Freedom of speech is important. He's got a right to his opinion. You don't have to agree with him. You don't have to like it. He's got a right to an opinion. And it's not a matter of phobia. It's a matter of this absolutely pernicious whoring to minorities. That's the Canadian Hate Network, have filed complaints with the Real Estate Council of Ontario and Immigration Consultants of Canada Regulatory Council, and contacted his employer just before his bigoted tweet, Huda retweeted the Toronto Sun columnist Tarek Fatah, who is incidentally a Muslim, advertising a petition against calls to prayer. Now, what's wrong with that? It's a petition. You don't have to sign it. You don't have to agree with it. Whatever became of freedom of speech. Well, it's a fast disappearing commodity. So what's happened? Well, Rabbi Huda has been fired from Remax and removed from his role as chair. I don't think he's a chair. I think he's probably a chairman of appeal board counsel after our formal complaint. He's being held accountable. Do you see where the way the game is played today? The price of dissent is unemployment. They don't say, we don't agree with this guy, Rabbi Huda. We think he's wrong. Fair enough. He's got an opinion. They've got an opinion. And maybe if both sides can explain themselves, reasonable people could figure out which one makes more sense. No. He said something politically incorrect. He must be destroyed. And look who's collaborating. Remax Canada. And I call them that. They are shameful corporate collaborators in the squelching of free speech. And I wrote to Remax. I said I was a customer, a client of yours. Well, I was at one point. And I said, in a pompous little statement, they say they're for multiculturalism and diversity. And I call them on that. But not diversity of opinion. This guy, Rabbi Huda, was simply expressing his opinion. But apparently doesn't have the right to that opinion because it's not the right opinion. Because you disagree with special privileges for Muslims, then you're a hater. I don't see any evidence of hate. And what's he suggesting? They burn the mosque down? No. Sign a petition complaining to the local government. That's a citizen's right. In fact, to the extent that the Canadian Anti-Hate Network was trying to squelch Rabbi Huda, trying to punish him for exercising his rights, I think that this is a good case of interfering with civil liberties of the real sort. We are really in a desperate battle for freedom. And I urge you, if you've ever dealt with Remax, to contact them and say, how dare you? How can you punish a guy for his opinion? He didn't claim to be speaking on behalf of Remax. He was claiming to be speaking on behalf of himself. Now, isn't that his right? I mean, doesn't he have a right to an opinion? I mean, to express an opinion? Well, apparently not. And, this is really serious, what is happening. Well, last week, the trust fund kid decided to make good on a long-standing promise to reduce even further the rights of Canadian gun owners. He's banned about 1,500 different brand names of assault rifles. And that's going to do something about gun violence. Well, they talk about gang violence, gang gun violence. Well, gang gun violence is mostly in the big cities, mostly in Toronto, Mississauga, Hamilton, and mostly perpetrated by, we don't often hear it, Jamaican and Somali gangs. Almost always using handguns. So what's banning assault rifles got to do with that? Carrying a handgun without a permit, and none of these dudes has a permit. None of them has a permit even to own the handgun. So how is slapping down legitimate gun owners and collectors, what does that have to do with gun violence? Well, it has nothing to do with it, but it has everything to do with control. So Rebel News today states, Justin Trudeau is using a cynical ploy to take our firearms away. The Prime Minister's minority Liberal government has recently released a list of 1,500 firearms and accessories that will be outlawed in Canada. But this list is not about improving public safety. No, This weapons ban is nothing more than an authoritarian assault on legal, law-abiding firearms owners. I think Trudeau's exploiting two tragedies to ramrod his anti-gun agenda into law. The recent mass shooting in Nova Scotia, there were 22 people killed, which was not perpetrated by a legal gun owner, and the COVID-19 related smackdown of our civil liberties. And it turns out that this sentiment is not unique. This is a reporter for Rebel Media, Harold Menzies. I ventured out to Queen's Park to cover an anti-gun grab protest, and I bumped into several protesters who articulated similar views. Did you hear what one protester said? My background gets checked every day. This is not the crux of what I'm talking about here. Canadian firearms owners have to go through extremely rigorous background tests, checks just to own a single firearm. And firearms-related crimes in Canada are almost never committed by legally licensed citizens. So will the Trudeau gun grab result in gangbangers getting rid of their illegal handguns? Will it change the behavior of deranged mass murder shooters? Of course not. It's all about control, not about crime control. It's control of law-abiding citizens. It's somewhat analogous to you having a cold, your neighbor having a cold, and some bureaucrat coming along and jamming antihistamines down your throat. It makes no sense. And there is no connection. This is all about a power grab. And this is a report today from Rebel Media. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me as we wait in here where our internet connection is.
God is my ultimate authority, and I'm not going to bow the knee to any man, tyrant. Doesn't matter. I will stand free. Come and take them. That's the only way you're going to get them. Folks, can you imagine using a global pandemic and a tragic event as a means to further a political agenda, without any discourse or debate, something that was ramrodded through via an order in council? Well, that's what the Justin Trudeau Liberals did the other day. They had an order in council banning so many legal firearms, making them illegal at a future date, and making legal gun owners criminals at that date unless they turned them in. Well, I was at the protest on Saturday at Queen's Park, and I bumped into one gun owner, and he was very vocal about this particular injustice. Hi, sir. How you doing? I couldn't help but notice your sign. Come and take it. There's a couple of rifles there. I guess this is in reference, I would imagine, to what just happened the last several days in Parliament with these new gun restrictions.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. If Trudeau thinks he can just change the laws on us with no vote or anything, no stats to back the bans. You know, the recent Nova Scotia shooter, he was already banned from owning weapons. He had a record. I am a legal gun owner. I went through the licensing process. My background gets checked every day. And these are actually two of my own personal guns that I traced out. And that one is actually now considered illegal.
What models are these two guns, sir?
So this is the McAfee Defense SLR, and this is the Stag 10. So that's a 308 rifle, that's a 5.56. And they're both non-restricted, so I can take them hunting, I can take them shooting on private land. But as of yesterday, now that one, I could face, you know, prison time for doing that. So,
and sir, do you think that the Trudeau Liberals are using the Wuhan virus and perhaps even the tragedy that happened in Nova Scotia with the mass shooting as an excuse to do an undemocratic gun grab?
Absolutely. He's using all of that combined as a distraction, you know. People are scared to come out. It's nice because there's not a lot of Liberals out here because they're all scared to come out, but it's all a distraction, right? So he uses the media, mainstream media, pushes false narratives. We have doctors who somehow think they know about guns, and they're not even licensed, I would bet. They tried to ban handguns, that didn't go through, but I wouldn't be surprised if they tried for that. So I'm going to take a firm stance, and I'm not going to give up any of my guns, you know. There's an amnesty until 2022, April 30th. And then you have until that day to turn your weapons in if they're now legal. And so my question is, what happens at that date if it doesn't get reversed, if the Liberals are still in power? But yeah, the guns, they're not going anywhere. I speak for, not directly, obviously, but I know a lot of guys who feel the same way. So if you want to maintain a peaceful country, don't try to come and take people's guns. We've seen it happen.
And you have to wonder, sir, even if you supported gun restrictions, such as we've seen this week, at the end of the day, do you think restricting these guns, going after legal, law-abiding gun owners like you, is this going to stop one criminal from getting an illegal gun and killing anyone in the years to come?
Absolutely not. It's ridiculous. Changing the restrictions on these is not going to change crime at all. Criminals, most who use handguns anyway, which are purchased illegally, either straw purchasing or through the states getting smuggled in. So why doesn't he crank down on border security instead of coming after illegal gun owners like me and millions of other Canadians?
Or do you think in this day and age, being pro-gun is a third rail politically to step on?
It seems like it's a third rail only because, based on Scheer's platform for this last election, obviously he went around to the CCFR and did interviews with them and said, oh yeah, I'm pro-gun, but, you know, being pro-guns means owning guns, being not willing to give them up no matter who says it, and, you know, live free or die. And so that's what I plan on doing. I'm not going to bow the knee to any man. I serve Jesus Christ and Jesus Christ alone. And so our Constitution or Charter of Rights actually says right at the beginning, this is a country founded upon the recognition of the supremacy of God and the rule of law. So God is my ultimate authority, and I'm not going to bow the knee to any man, tyrant, doesn't matter. I will stand free, come and take him. That's the only way you're going to get him.
Well, he was certainly very passionate about the gun ban, wasn't he, folks? And you know what? We share his passion. We are not going to allow Justin Trudeau to exploit the Wuhan virus pandemic and the Nova Scotia massacre as a means for him to ramrod through legislation making legal gun owners illegal gun owners, making legal guns illegal guns. It's just not right. It's just not democratic. So please visit our newest website, handsoffourguns.ca. That's
handsoffourguns.ca, and that was put on by Rebel Media. And that's this type of pushback is long overdue. I think a lot of people were shocked by the nerve of the Trudeau government, but perhaps shouldn't be shocked. This is not anything particularly new. Here is a the utter hypocrisy, you know. Virus advisor resigns after breaking the rules. I dealt with this a little bit yesterday, but there's more goodies here. Married lover went to his home during lockdown. The British scientist whose advice prompted Prime Minister Boris Johnson to lock down the country resigned from his government advisory post on Tuesday night. As the Daily Telegraph, that's a big British paper, disclosed that he broke social distancing rules to meet with his married lover. It just gets better and better. Professor Neil Ferguson allowed the woman to visit him at home during lockdown while he lectured the public on the need for strict social distancing and to reduce the spread of coronavirus. The woman lives in her own house with her husband and two children. Now, but you're not supposed to do that in Britain. And he was the lead person hooting and hollering about all these restrictions. The epidemiologist leads a team at Imperial College London that produced the computer model research which claimed more than 500,000 people in Britain would die without the national lockdown. Now, Sweden doesn't have a national lockdown. And I mean, 500,000 would be Britain has a population of about 65 million people. That'd be about one in every 130. But would die. Not just get it, but would die. Now, this was a projection. And similar projections were made in Canada and the United States. In Canada, we were told, in Ontario alone, we were told of a population of about 14 million people, between 100 and 200,000 people would die. if nothing was done? Well, it scared, it just absolutely terrified the British government. He's frequently taken to the media to support lockdown and praised very intensive social distancing. Ferguson's resignation comes as the United Kingdom's death toll passed 22,000, making it the highest recorded death count from coronavirus in Europe. Okay, I mean, that's not good, of course. I mean, that anybody would die is not a good thing. But come on, wait a sec. This is not, what was it? I mean, the original scare tactics were 500,000 people would die. He helped railroad Britain, and indirectly, because many people in North America cited the absolute scare scenario from the Imperial College in London, cited this as reason for the lockdown of society. The disclosure of the illegal meetings will infuriate couples living apart whom the government has banned from meeting up during the crackdown, now in its seventh week. Yeah, the conditions are much worse in Britain than here. In Canada, couples who, for whatever reason, were apart, let's say they were working in different cities, or were living apart, are not allowed to reunite. I mean, that's cruel. Meanwhile, he was having his girlfriend come on over to his place. On at least two occasions, her name's Antonia Staats, Staats, 38, traveled from her South London home across the capital to spend time with a 51-year-old scientist nicknamed Professor Lockdown, who had just completed 2 weeks self-isolating after testing positive for the virus. So he felt he was okay. But that's not the rule imposed on other people. Other people are not told, well, if you don't think you've got coronavirus, you can, you know, reunite with your wife or your husband. No. You're just kept isolated. You know, arbitrary state power. Anyway, he said he deeply regretted this. The first of Staats' visits on March 30th coincided with a public warning by Ferguson that the then week-down lockdown measures would remain until June. So, do as I say, not as I do. Staats is a left-wing campaigner. She made a second visit on April 8th. Despite telling friends she suspected her husband, an academic in his 30s, had COVID-19 symptoms. The couple and their children live in a $3.3 million home and are understood to be in an open marriage. Well, their sexual relations is neither here nor there to me. Their sexual arrangements. but there's their absolutely glaring hypocrisy. Grant Shapps, the transport secretary, recently reminded the public that it was illegal to be outside the home for any other than four reasons: medical emergency, daily exercise, essential food shopping, and for certain types of work. Otherwise, you're a prisoner. You only thought you lived in the free world. No, you're a prisoner. The police in England and Wales have handed out more than 9,000 fines during the lockdown, equivalent to one every 5 minutes. That's a police state. Cut it any way you like, that's a police state. And that's what people are rebelling against. So you have to ask about the good Professor Ferguson, your Professor Lockdown, or whatever he's called. Do you really believe this stuff? If he believed it, then he's incredibly hypocritical. I mean, if he really, really believed you need this totalitarian imprisonment lockdown for public health, then how could he twice have his girlfriend, mistress, whatever, married, come on over to his place. Especially after the second time, she'd been telling friends she thought her own husband had, that's the one she's screwing around, has coronavirus. I mean, it is madness. So, point being, are we taking direction from people like that? Well, why should we? We're taking direction from certifiable idiots. And that's being nice. That's probably being unfair to idiots. And it's got to stop. And I think that's what a lot of people are saying. Well, it's time for me to take my my musical break now. Tonight. And I'm going to play some tunes that were written by Whispering Bill Anderson over the years, a great songwriter and a great promoter of country and western talent for so many years in Nashville, Tennessee. This is a great song that he wrote. So many people recorded it. This is called the Keys in the Mailbox. And why don't we try a version by the lovely Connie Smith. This is one of her early hits, The Keys in the Mailbox, and she's recorded it so many times over the years.
Lord, jealous me and careless you, the odds were just too great. I couldn't take those lonely nights, you made me sit and wait. When you walked out of sight, instead I see you in my dreams each night. The keys in the mailbox, come on in.
Smith, the keys in the mailbox. Come on in. And
come on, cousin.
Well, I think we just heard that one, so why don't we try another one by cute and country Connie Smith, I Never Once Stopped Loving You. This is another one.
My dreams were
That's Connie Smith. Here's another one by Connie, Yesteryear in Nashville, Connie Smith. And this is, I believe, an interview with her, and hopefully we'll have some songs here.
Got Connie Smith involved in the country music business. A native of Elkhart, Indiana, Connie suffered a severe leg injury in her youth that caused her to be hospitalized for some time. While convalescing, she taught herself to play the guitar. Later, she began to sing as well and participated in local shows and talent contests. In 1963, while attending a show in Columbus, Ohio, some of her friends persuaded her to enter a talent contest, which she won, and this led to her meeting Bill Anderson. A few months later, she and her husband saw Bill once again and renewed their acquaintance. Bill invited her to come to Nashville and sing on a show he was hosting. After a short time, she was signed to RCA Records and recorded a Bill Anderson song, Once a Day, which reached number one on the national charts. In 1964, she was named Most Promising Country Female Singer by Billboard magazine. During the 60s, Connie had several other top 10 records and appeared in several country music motion pictures. A spiritual awakening caused her to re-examine her life, her career, and her priorities, and she began living her life with a close relationship with God. And here is Connie Smith as she appeared back in 1966 with a top 10 hit.
Oh!
was The Hurtin's Over by today's special guest, Miss Connie Smith. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Archie.
You get prettier every day you live.
Thank you. I try.
You know, I was in the studio when you first came down. I each don't remember that because the excitement was pretty strong for you, but I was in there with Chet. And you came in, I know it was there in the 60s. When was it?
64.
64? I was in the studio when you came down the first time. I thought it was a pretty little girl. You looked the same as you did then.
Oh,
I understand it was an accident that you had when you were real young that was partly responsible for you starting in the music business. Now, how did that happen?
I was mowing the yard, and I rocked, hit the mower, and it hit my leg, and did a lot of damage to it. So all I could do was stay in the bed for quite a while. And because of that, I bought me a guitar for $7 and tried to learn how to play.
What kind was it?
It was a Gibson, but it was ruined when I got it.
Well, and is that when you decided, when did you want to be in show business?
When I was 5, I remember saying I'm going to be on the Grand Ole Opry.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, you did it before the accident then.
Really? I never really thought that it would happen. I wanted to. And then when I was in high school, I said, I'm going to sing on the Grand Ole Opry. I put that in my prompt, in the yearbook. But I said it was the last, so people think I was fooling, because in case I never got it.
Now, Bill Anderson had something to do with your success in the business. What was that?
When I met Bill, we were talking about country music, and I was just so thrilled that a real live Grand Ole Opry star, would even pay attention and talk to me like I was a real person, because I'd never met one. And Bill was so nice to us, and he was saying, "Well, you like the country music so much, and all this so much, why don't you come to Nashville?" And I said, "Oh yeah, sure, just like that, I'll come to Nashville." And he said, "No kidding, I'm going to do on the Sub Record Shop in March." So that was in March of 63, and or 64. And he said, "Why don't you come down and be a guest?" And
made you come to Nashville.
Right.
Yeah.
And that thrilled me to death because just that was my dream, just to come down.
Had you been to Nashville before?
Never had. And I remember it cost me $80 for my ticket to fly to Nashville. And I got there that night. I got to go to the Grand Ole Opry, and I sat backstage and watched Bill Phillips' little boy while he was out singing on stage, and I thought I was big stuff.
I had just standing like that.
Yes, just a bit.
Now, what happened between the time you got here to you got your first recording contract?
Well, I came in March, and then I just got to see everything and sang on Ernest Tubb Record Shop, and then I heard from Bill. I went back home to Ohio, and I heard from Bill, and he told me that he had written some songs that he wanted some demonstration tapes made on. And he'd written one for Kitty Wells and one for Cedar Davis and some songs and a duet. And he'd wanted me to come down and sing those songs on the tape in May. So I did. I came down May the 28th and came down and sang all the songs. And he took them to Hubert Long, that was his manager at the time. And Hubert took them across the street to Chet Atkins. And Chet heard the tape. And of course, Chet knows a good thing when he saw it. And I'm not talking about my singing. He knew that Bill Anderson was involved, and at that time, Bill's writing, he thought, if I can get some of that channeled into RCA, that's great. I'm sure that he thought that. And so knowing that Bill was going to write some of my material, Chet said, we'll sign it up.
I remember when Chet said, "So don't you hear a gal, so we got a gal here that can sing." Now, when he says that, that's about all, He don't go crazy about it. Making a big thing about each of this gal can sing.
I'm still in awe of Chet Atkins. I remember him coming in the studio when I was recording my album, and I was doing okay. I'd never really sung with music, and when you need a curse, singer snickered when I said, "What's a turnaround?" I can handle that. But when I looked in the control room and saw Chet Atkins, I said, "What was it? I Don't Love You Anymore." So mm-hmm. The song I was singing. And I saw him, and I blew the next four lines of the song, because I couldn't believe that he was in there. It just scared me to death.
What is a turnaround?
In the middle of the song, that's where they just play the last line that you're going to
sing. So you can get your breath and take a
I think
breath off.
Right, yeah.
Now, you were 18 years old then, or how old?
I was 23 when I came to Nashville.
23, married, and you had a child, didn't you?
I had a little boy. He was almost 2.
Yeah. How did your family feel about you going in the show business?
I don't know if they really thought a whole lot about it. My mother wanted to make sure when everybody started bragging on me that they didn't brag on me any more than the rest of the kids, so she had to tell them all the good things about the others. And I don't, I'm proud of her, but I'm no more proud of her than I am of Jackie and Carol and Freddie, and Two Stars and all the others.
Right. Wow, sure. Well, that's happened to me any time it happened. You don't know who it's going to happen to. It might not have been you. It might have been another sister.
It could have been you.
Now, Bill Anderson, of course, wrote Once a Day. Mm-hmm. And, tell us about that. How did you decide to record that?
How
did he decide?
Actually, Bill was the one that told Chet he would help find material. Mm-hmm. And he went back to the house and started running through some songs that he had written, and he found one that he had started about 3 years prior and hadn't finished. And he picked it up and he started writing on it, and that was Once a Day.
Once a Day?
So I've always said that I don't think Bill knew what he had when he gave it to me, or he gave it to someone that he knew was made a hit, but it's a great song. There's been I know several years ago there had been over 50 people that had recorded it after I did, so I just was real fortunate to get that song.
And there's a lot more to that interview, but got a good introduction to Connie Smith, and this is Paul Fromm. I'm signing off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and catch me again tomorrow on WhiteResistanceRadio.com or AltWhiteTV.com.